What up, what up? Here we go. Another episode, Connected Show. We're going to be joined today by an old school homie of mine. Met him back in the 90s, KJ52, world-renowned rap artist. He's been consistent throughout his whole entire career, and he happens to be in San Diego, so we're going to be catching up with him. We're going to share some old school stories and kind of see how the industry's changed for him and what he's up to now. So make sure you tune in, spread the word. This episode is brought to you by Milton Motion. Always doing big things. Thanks, Tim. Always good looking out for everything you do for us and the Love Thy Neighbor movement. Also, this episode is also brought to you by the Love Thy Neighbor movement. So make sure you you check out what we're doing. We got a new website thanks to Tim Hernandez. And, it's one of those things where, I always hate to ask for stuff. And now, since the holiday season, we've been asking for donations and whatnot for the events that we have going on and the projects and whatnot. So make sure you hit the donate button, throw a little something our way. We don't care if it's $2, $5, $200, $2,000. We're taking it all. And we're doing some good stuff with it on this side and that side of the border. So let's go ahead and make some stuff happen before this wall comes up and we can't do much. Just kidding. Ain't getting political. But anyway, let's do this. Let's get into this next episode with my boy KJ52. Let's do this. Get
If you're C-O-N-E-C-T-A-D-O, you already know about the show, so let's go. It's your music and lifestyle, fashion profile, the entertainment source for everything you want to know about. North to the south, the east to the west side, stay connected with Ruben Torres worldwide, so let's go. Across the globe, well respected, beasting on the industry. Connected.
Out here in San Diego with my boy KJ.
What's up, man?
KJ52EZ.
Every 20 years, I come to San Diego and do something with you.
We're out here at the Grand Marquis Marriott, yeah, in downtown San Diego.
Yep.
And every 20 years, I think it is.
But I don't want to come back in 20 years.
60. We'll be 60.
Let's not talk about numbers. Let's not talk about numbers.
Man. So, man, when you told me you were out here, I just, I was like, man, I gotta catch up.
Yeah.
Catch up and reminisce. Man, I don't even know where to start, man. We go way back, man.
Very true.
Since what would you say? How 96?
I met you in 96, but I was a fan of POD from afar. They would come and play a spot in Florida called The Refuge, yeah, and I had a good homie from high school that used to come and watch them, and they would talk about just Sonny's boldness on stage, and he said, and yeah, there was a rap group opened up for him. It's two guys, rough smoothness.
Something like that,
and... So I remember just that early scene of Christian hip hop, and I was always kind of, I looked at Cali as like very progressive and very supportive, and there was so many things popping off in Cali, so I thought if I could ever make it out here, I could actually make it.
And you did. You made it out here.
I did. Well, before I made it out here, I made it to Nashville. I was in Bible college for one whole semester, and I pooled my money and drove to Nashville to try to get a record deal for GMA Week. I had cassette tapes that I had dubbed in my dorm.
The King
no,
J Mac.
I had to borrow somebody's dorm to dub them. That's how sad I was. And nobody would pay attention. Nobody would listen. This little booth, Rescue Records, had a sampler. And it was like half like punk bands. The other half was rap groups.
And nobody was doing that.
Nobody.
Yeah. Pioneers.
And I never forget, I walked up to you and you were just super chill. And you took my demo. And I think you invited me up to the room, like, you want to come kick it? And I don't know if you remember this, but you said something about smoking a cigar.
Yeah.
Do you remember
that? I used to smoke cigars.
You smoked cigars, and I was like, yo, man, you shouldn't smoke cigars. It's going to ruin your witness.
And what did I say?
I just remember looking at your face because it was like you were like, you just insulted the A&R guy, like you just called him to the mat of and I in my head, that's I always awesome. Felt like you were like something about that like caught your attention, that I didn't care enough about my status to, even my misdirected zeal for, like, you know, my zeal for the Lord was sometimes misdirected in trying to be a little bit too judgmental towards other people. I've chilled out over the years.
I was telling Tim on the way here about, like, when we met, but I think automatically, like, when we started talking, like, you know, your spirit is what I was, like, magnetized to. I was like, dude, you know, this dude, man, you know, Jonah, I was like, yeah, he's just dope, you know. And you were working with the youth I don't know if you're a youth pastor yet.
Not yet, but I was about to be, in a couple of years. Yeah.
And I was like, man, this dude's about it, you know. And, and, you know, with the, I'd gotten saved in 94, end of 94, 95-ish. So I was still, you know, kind of fresh.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I used to smoke cigars, and I used to do it like that.
Oh,
you know,
I got so hung up on that. Yeah. But in hindsight, I think I almost felt like you, because I wasn't going to kiss somebody's butt just for the sake of getting a deal.
Yeah.
And there was something about that, even though I wasn't like a gangster street kid or something like that, I didn't do dirt. I mean, I lived in the hood, but I wasn't that. But I always really got along well with people that did come from that lifestyle. There was something. Because maybe just because I always tried to be myself, I never put on any fronts, and I always just got along really well with, like, because people that have been, like, really through the ringer, they've really done their dirt, they're very real people.
Yeah.
They're very upfront. They're, you know where you stand with them, and they respect authenticity.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I felt like, without really knowing you, I was like, he's got to be one of those guys, because the next thing out of your mouth was like, yeah, if you get on Rescue Records, we'll shave your head and put some tattoos on you.
That was the SoCal culture, dude. You gotta
you understand, like, I'm coming from Florida, so all Hispanics in Florida, like, Caribbean culture, there's no, like, cholo culture, there's no, like, low riders, there's no concept of, like, shaving your head and, like, looking like something from, like, a little homies
blood in, blood out
movie. Exactly. I had no comprehension of that, but long story short, I remember we stayed in touch, and then I started talking with the owner of Rescue.
Noah.
Yeah. And he's like, yeah, at Rescue Records, we let all our artists write their own record deals. I'm like, hey, for real? He's like, yeah, we let them write their own record deals. So send over what you want in a record deal. And I remember
crazy.
I was like, I want 90% of my record sales, and, like, I want to keep all of my masters, and, like, it was just dumb. I don't know what I was thinking. Of course, that never happened. And then you were like, yo, man, I think I'm gonna end up doing my own thing. And we had stayed in touch for the next couple of years. Is that right?
Yeah.
So I had gone on staff at the church. Me and Golden Child were, like, an official group.
Sons of Intellect.
Yeah.
So you went from King J Mac.
King J Mac, that's right.
You went from King J Mac to Sons of Intellect.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, you were already KJ52.
Yes. King J Mac didn't last long, thank God. Here comes my burger, praise the Lord.
And all the background noise and all the stuff, we're in the lobby here.
Dang, that is a burger.
Can I get some water? Some water?
That is a
huge burger.
That is a lot.
What is that?
Ridiculously fried meat.
I wish you guys can see this.
This is like two chickens put together.
Two chickens.
It's a whole yard of chickens.
With half a pig.
I'm not eating all that.
That's crazy, man.
I'm trying to drop some baby weight.
Yeah, I don't know if you'd probably disappear if you drop some like that. But we are here at the Marriott.
Yeah.
And we're in the, I don't know what this area is, the lounge out here. And KJ is just macking on some ridiculous sandwich burger thing.
I'm going to come back with the flavor.
And no, mac it, dude.
No.
So
knock me out for the whole night.
So we're out here. KJ's in San Diego. Tell me what you're in San Diego for.
So,
thank you, sir.
I find myself doing these corporate events every once in a while. In this case, it's called Financial Advisors Excel. It's a friend of mine works there, so I've actually done a bunch of content for them, writing songs, the, like, year-end wrap-ups, birthday wraps. I did a graffiti piece for them, probably one of the bigger pieces I've ever done. Little did I know they based their entire campaign around this graffiti piece.
Yeah.
And so they started coming to me, and they basically said, hey, can you help us kind of plan some of the event? We want it to have, like, this street party feel. we haven't ever done anything like that, so we want it to be like art and hip-hop and all this stuff. I'm like, you're a bunch of financial planners. Like, is this really what you want? They're like, yep. I couldn't be here for the whole week, so I ended up hooking them up with Propaganda. He's doing a spoken word piece. Hooked them up with my DJ, who they locked down for the whole weekend, who I could not use.
They just jacked
it. Jacked them. But the main thing I was here to do was their street party. I sent him a video of me doing an art walk where I was freestyling with people coming through the art walk and stuff. So essentially what I just did was a freestyle show, similar to what I've just done for years and years, but just in that sense.
And then I just seen the card,
right?
The key cards here at the Marquis Marriott.
Yeah. Crazy.
Have your artwork on them.
It's crazy.
Which is nuts. That's...
You have no idea. You have to understand, man. Like, I ran from art because my parents were artists. So me, art represented poverty, divorce, you know, struggle, never making it. I jokingly would say to my dad, I'm going to be a lawyer. That was my way of rebelling. And to now do art for a different purpose, like, even though I got a long way to go to get better, but, you know, it's just a great way to express yourself.
But that's something you've always had. You've always had that element of art, the graffiti, right?
You know what it was? Hip-hop helped me recontextualize art for me. You know what I'm saying? So, like, my dad was a tile painter, but I couldn't relate to that, even though it was murals, and murals are murals, but hip-hop made art dope to me because it was rebellious, it was getting your name out there, you know what I mean? It was taking something that was never intended to be used as an art thing. Spray cans were never intended to be used for art.
Yeah.
And they did, you know? So I just fell in love with that. I love the idea of, like, making your name look dope. Like, I was always bored in class. So I was just trying to do my bubble name and stuff like that. So,
and so you own that element of hip-hop and also the rap element.
Yeah.
Did you DJ and break dance as well?
I think any kid in the early 80s tried to break dance.
I break dance.
I was like, definitely... Yeah, oh yeah. I was probably a dancer before I ever was a rapper, but... I was getting into, like, the Kid and Play era, and so, like, choreographed dancing and stuff like that. But, yeah, I tried to DJ. I never had the hand skills. When I worked at that church, my church bought me turntables. I was pretty terrible.
Well, every now and then I go out and I check out some of the homies' videos. Like, oh, let's see who's doing what. And I seen some of the videos you put out. And you did a lot of dancing in your videos. There's several videos where you do a lot of dancing. Tell me about that. What made you switch over to do some of that stuff?
I'm just saying. Something about a good, well put off, well placed running man, the right time.
So we're in an era, man, where hip hop just isn't what it used to be.
Yes.
What's your thoughts on the state of hip hop right now?
I don't think you can ever hold your hand, like, hip-hop will never be able, you can't just hold it down and go, this is what you have to be forever. It's just always in the state of being recontextualized for the youth, because they're always going to reinterpret it for their own generation. So I think you have to be very careful to not go, well, that's not the way it was for me, so it's not good. The reality is that they said the same thing about us when we were kids. So, yeah, for me, I had this conversation with my DJ. It was like, turntablism and scratching and cutting and mixing and all that stuff was our generation. The next generation is what the EDM DJs are doing, which is really not DJing, but it's how they've recontextualized what DJing is.
Yeah.
Graffiti art, for what it was for my generation, has now been recontextualized into what we would call street art or Banksy type stuff or stenciling. It's the next evolution of what people think art is. If I do graffiti art, people go, oh, I love Banksy. I'm like, no, it's a totally different thing. But and hip-hop, you know, obviously has changed from where in my generation it was about freestyling and you know, originality and uniqueness and
lyrics
and lyrics and content. And that's still there, but let's be real, that, you know, mumble rap is the new thing.
God.
You know what I'm saying?
I wish that would go away.
But sometimes we think, oh, that's the worst thing ever, but realize we've always had things like this in rap. I mean, did we forget that, you know, everybody was putting iggities and biggities in their rhymes, you know, in the early 90s?
Yeah, that's true.
You know what I mean? Like, there's always been styles and things that have changed, and the youth will always recontextualize. I mean, if you grew up in 90s golden era hip hop, you looked at the 80s and the 70s rappers as old school and played out.
Yeah.
now the new generation might look at the 90s as the same thing. I mean, it's always going to be that way, but great music is great music, great songs are great songs, and I think there always will be a desire for content.
Yeah.
You know, and the same thing with breakdancing. Like, yeah, people still break, and that's still a thing, but really, you know, that's even been reinterpreted to what it is.
Yeah. It's the evolution of what it was and what it's becoming is it's never going to be what it used to be.
The funny thing that I did realize, though, is because I came up in an era where you had to freestyle, now that I've still stayed with that skill set all these years later, it really kind of left me as the last man standing. So I can go in and freestyle for kids, and they are in legitimate awe because nobody does it anymore.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Some kids might try, but I had to come to a realization that that is not the test of what a dope rapper is anymore.
Yeah.
But if you can do it, it's still like a way to be like, oh, crap.
Yeah. Dude's doing it.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I look at my era or my generation of hip-hop as a beautiful time to come up, but I can't stay stuck in that mindset. Yeah. You know what I mean? So.
Well, let's take it to the business side of it real quick. You know, we're talking about from back when you were handing out cassette tapes.
Yeah.
And looking for record deals, and yes. then you land a record deal with BEC.
No, Essential Records.
Essential.
Yes.
And then BEC.
You know what? Hold on. Let's stop, because I never would have got that deal if it wasn't for you.
All right. Tell me about that.
Tell you about that.
Tell me about that.
Tell about how you did that. So you started Cosa Nostra Records, and that was when me and Golden Child were still a crew. We broke up, and I thought, oh, he's not going to want to mess with me anymore, because I was just feeling down about myself. And you're like, no, I'll keep messing with you. And you sent me some money to go in the studio. Well, it was that money is what became my first demo, my first solo album, which became the deal that I got a record deal with. And you very unselfishly helped pay me, you know, helped pay for that studio time when I was a broke youth pastor making $7.50 an hour working in the hood. And wow. I don't know if I've ever really said thank you to that. You know, but I mean, that was a big deal, and I never signed the deal with you. I never signed with Cosa Nostra.
No, but we talked about that, and I was getting more into the video and the film stuff,
right?
And you said, "Hey, man, we need to get some distribution," and
that was where I drew the line. Yes.
Yeah, and I was like, "Man, you know, give me some time because I'm working on this other stuff."
Yep.
And you're like, "Hey, well, some other opportunities are coming. What if?" You know, I explored some opportunities, and I was like, dude, I'm not going to be the guy that's going to hold you back.
That was very unselfish of you. And for the record, I did pay him back. Thank you very much.
But
you remember
what?
That when I paid you back?
Yeah. But you know what?
Sent you the money.
To me, I never expected anything out of it. Like, to me, like I said, when we met back in 96, to me, I was like, this dude's heart is what makes the difference. And to this day, that's why I've always like just even like reach out every like once a year or whatever it is, like,
yeah.
Yo, you know, what's up, man? What are you doing? Just, you know, because you're heart of it. I
am mad at you, though. You didn't get me on MTV's The Cut.
Yeah, those the other white kids that I got into.
Ruben had a weird affinity for white rappers when nobody was touching white rappers.
Right. I'm telling you, man, I could have just blew open the doors with that whole thing. Yeah. Talking about Illharmonics.
Yes.
Yeah. And Plato. Plato's still one of my favorite MCs.
That's awesome. Plato's really dope, man.
Yeah.
He's one of the few guys left from that era that's still doing. I mean, granted, we're in two different markets. I feel like he's mainly in the mainstream, would you say?
Yeah.
But
and then Dirt was my other white rapper. And
You were like the white rapper whisperer.
Man, I should have stayed in that niche right there. I'm telling you. So then you got these deals.
Yes.
And tell me, like, What changed when you got these deals?
Well, so the money that you gave me, and then the money that this little couple at my church gave me, I went into the studio to work on my first album, which became Seventh Avenue. But all I really wanted, like going back to what you're talking about, all I really wanted to do was press up my music and give it away. That's literally all I wanted to do. I wanted to go on the streets because I was working with Housing Project kids, and those kids were basically, you know, they had nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So you saw my heart, and so did this, you know, so this couple. And just to contextualize it, like, my church was probably 99% black. This couple was an old white couple, like a retiree couple.
Yeah.
And they just believed in the ministry. And I took that money and I went in the studio and I ended up spending all the money. All the money went to the record. And I'll never forget this, because I was like, all right, you know, I'll get a record deal and then I'll get my advance and then I'll be able to give out my music. And I never forget God really like impressing my heart, like, you need to be obedient to what I told you to do in the first place. I'm like, God, I make $7 an hour at this church. How am I going to afford this? I've spent all the money making the record. And I sent off the demos to be, I sent off the single to be made up. And within 2 weeks, I got a phone call from Todd Collins from Goatee Records.
Yeah.
And I had a choice right then, because I felt like, man, you know, I got Ruben back in San Diego, but he doesn't have any distribution. I don't want to get hemmed up in a deal where I'm sitting around forever. I'm going to go for this deal. Todd kept me hanging for like 6 months. I finally ended up signing with Essential Records. And I had always heard stories of just people just burning people, you know, especially in the money department. And I got my first advance, and I was like, I had never gotten that much money in one sitting.
Uh-huh.
And the temptation was to, like, be, just keep the money, man. Like, you got bigger problems. And I was like, no, integrity would tell me, go pay him back for his investment, even though I have no legal obligation to pay him back. But I knew that the people that believed in you when you were nothing, you know, those are people that you always stay connected to.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? They knew you when you were nobody. They believed in you when you were nobody else believed in you. I find it interesting that here I am all these years later, 20 years later, I'm back independent, putting out my old record.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll get to that part.
Well, anyway, so I got my deal. I hit the road. I got dropped within 6 months. It was a terrible situation.
So
I gave it all up, man. Like, I gave it all up to hit the road. And within 6 months, the label's like, we're dropping you.
Why? Why'd you get dropped?
Because I didn't sell enough records. They were like, we invested this much. They were owned by a secular company, mainstream company. And they said, you know what?
Yeah, it was EMI or something.
They were owned by Jive.
Jive. That's
yeah,
right,
they were owned by Jive Records. And it was like the era of Britney Spears and everybody's selling millions of records on Jive. And they're like, here's this little white boy. He sold 20,000 copies. They're like, dump him. And I gave up everything. And within that first year, man, I had got my car repossessed. I went, you know, severely in debt from not paying my taxes. I got evicted from my apartment almost. Got dropped by the label. And all that money I burned through within 6 months.
Wow.
It was crazy. It was a terrible time.
Wow. Some dark times.
It was very dark. I was looked at it as like a broken experiment. It was like Nashville was like signing all these Christian rappers at the time. And it was supposed to be like the next wave, and none of it popped.
Wow.
You know?
Selling 20,000 records today, though,
I know, would be like a success.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
It's like top of the charts.
It'd be like, this guy's multi-billion platinum.
Yeah.
But it taught me a lot. It taught me just about how not to spend your money, how not to live in excess. It also taught me that God's calling is not based on whatever your circumstances are. And so I had to just push through for a year. No labels would sign me. Nobody in Nashville would sign me. I was looked at it as a busted experiment. And it wasn't until Blake Knight from Illharmonix kind of passed along that he was working with Tooth & Nail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I sold off their contract.
Right.
To,
isn't that funny how that ended up happening? They would always be like, yeah, Brandon rescued us from Rescue.
Well, yeah, they weren't even actually on Rescue, though.
I know, right?
But yeah, he did, because he had offered me a job, Brandon, he had offered me a job to run that hip-hop label.
Really, to run Uproxx? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he'd offered me a job, but he wanted me to move up to Seattle, and I was like,
nah,
dude, what the heck?
Heck no.
What the heck's in Seattle, dude? We can
Are
do
you going to get street tacos?
Yeah, so we can do it right here, dude, you know, and...
I didn't know that.
So, yeah, so he was just dead set on wanting to do it up in Seattle, and I said no, and I said, but I got these guys for you, and I sold off that contract to them, and that's when I just went full.
You were done with music by then, weren't you?
I still dabbled here and there, but I got more involved in the film industry and video, and just jumped into doing that, you know, full blast, and, you know, the rest is history.
I always find it hilarious that a Mexican former rapper was responsible for the careers of Tone, KJ52, Illharmonix, POD. I guess some major connections.
That's crazy, right? And to me, I'm like, dude, you know what?
You saw things in people that most people never did. Why? Like, I'm curious to know, why is that? What did you see?
I'm supposed to be asking the question.
I know, but this is you're answering my childhood question. That's 20 years ago. Why the heck would you? Why would you have messed with me? My skills were not.
No,
that great.
No. You know what? Like I
my
said,
my demo wasn't that great.
I think it was. It was the heart of it, dude. And
record labels don't sign people because they have good hearts.
I did. Because I signed Tone, I signed Dirt, I signed the ones that I felt that you know I was kind of. You know, push towards, and I think that was my part of. Yeah, you were dope. I mean, you weren't the dopest, but you were dope. And
you're being nice.
And
I had no clue what I was doing back then.
But you were doing the raw element, like what was the other Remnant Militia? Like those dudes, they were raw. You know what I'm saying? And I love that about like they weren't the dopest, but they were raw. And that's what I dug about them. That's what I dug about Dirt. You know what I'm saying? And I think. You know, adding the passion for what you're doing, the love for what you're doing with the raw talent is kind of what I've always seen in people. And I love that.
So I've always been curious. Did you bring the demo to Rescue and they were like, nah, we're not signing that guy when it came to me? Or was it just they were just trying to figure out what was going on?
Yeah, I think I brought it to Rescue. I brought it to Noah. And Noah, he was kind of thinking twice.
He didn't have any connection to me.
No, and he didn't... he really wasn't understanding the East Coast aspect of it. You know what I'm saying? And so when I brought him Unity Clan, he was like, oh, I get that. You know, because it was Latin. It was Low Riders. It was, you know what I'm saying?
It was San Diego.
Yeah. And he understood that aspect of it. And that's why I gravitated. Like, Dirt was sounding like, you know, Wu-Tang back in the day. You know what I'm saying? So, I love the East Coast hip hop. And to me, like, you know, okay, you don't get it. I'll do something with it, you know? And, you know, it's just differences or whatever, but you know, I'm sure you're glad that you didn't sign anything back then with that. But then you went to Brandon's label and he kind of blew you up.
Well, that was kind of weird because I floated for a year. Mm-hmm. I went to every major label in Nashville. Mm-hmm. I had meetings. Some of them came out to shows and, none of them would bite. They would all be like, oh, we want to hear new music, which is just code for we're not interested. Yeah. But one guy wanted me to do a rap rock thing, which I was even considering. But I just knew I was getting the runaround. And out of nowhere, you know, Brandon offered me a non-exclusive record deal, which never happens in the music industry. Yeah. So essentially, I could sign to him and sign to a whole other label at the same time. So in my head, I was like, you know what? I'll just float this record deal for now until I get a bigger deal. I'm gonna go ahead and sign it, not knowing that he would do a better job, you know. But you understand, like I had a very clear cut plan of what I was gonna do on my second album. I knew exactly the songs I was gonna do. I knew the image I was gonna project. I was in total revamp, rebranding mode, and I brought that to all the Nashville labels, and all the Nashville labels literally were like, "Well," and Brandon was like, "Okay." And I said to him, I'm sitting on this song that I wrote to Eminem, and people are kind of freaking out about it. I think it's going to be big.
Dear Slim.
I had been sitting on it the whole time, and I was like, I think it's going to be a big song. So he was smart enough to be like, all right. You know, he shot a video for it. Again, you know, the first record did 20,000. The second record did over 100,000.
Wow.
I mean, that's a huge leap. Yeah. So much so that the first label came back and tried to re-sign me.
Wow. Some nerve.
Well, they ended up putting the same record out again.
Wow. Yeah, that's how they do. They revisit that one. Oh,
It ended up doing another 70,000 copies. It was crazy.
As long as you get paid royalties on it.
No, I still have never made a royalty on it. Damn. It's still unrecouped. And for some reason, I still get statements. It makes no sense. But
you know what? That wasn't your first music video.
No, it wasn't. Nope, no, sir.
What was your first music video?
First music video was 20 years ago. He pointed this out to me. So it's funny, we're on the streets of San Diego. And he goes, oh, man, I don't know if you know this, but we shot your music video up the street. So the very first music video I shot in 1997 was for Worldwide. With cameos by Sonny from POD. I used to always tell people, like, 2 seconds, that's Sonny.
Who? That one right there? Just happened to walk by.
And then I forgot to tell you about the video. So you had this concept in the video that there was going to be this girl, right? And she represented hip hop, and we were running through the video trying to save her.
It just didn't work out for the cut.
None of that.
None of that worked out. It was just a random girl.
It was a random girl sitting in a bedroom looking depressed, right? So I'm telling my wife about this when I come back.
And she was upset, like, what the heck? Why do you have this girl?
No, she was my girlfriend at the time. And I said, yo, babe, I shot my first music video. I'm like, check this out. She's like, what's with the girl? I'm like, oh, she represents hip-hop. I'm like, she's just sitting in a bedroom with a swinging lamp. It has nothing to do with it.
We tried. But think about it. This was what, 90?
Oh, it was 97, man. 97? To have a video was just
Yeah, 97,
crazy.
Shot on film. Like, dude, that was nuts.
Very crazy.
And
the funny thing is, you were smart enough to do the technique where you shoot the video twice as fast.
Yeah.
And then you try to keep up.
Yeah.
And then you slow.
That.
Nobody did that. So it makes your hand motions really super slow. And then there was just random shots of us in a lowrider.
And then through the broken glass.
And then you had the guy that was a breakdancer who was terrible. You said you called him Big Bang Hank because he was flopping around on the ground.
Oh, man.
The funny thing was that video, like, because you, I think
But
you
got that got you noticed.
Oh, it definitely did.
And they played the crap out of it on
JCTV or Juice.
G-Rock.
That's G-Rock. Right.
I think they still play it to
this
day. Yeah,
and I remember, forget, like, when we flew all the way out to here. It was a long flight. And you were like, yeah, you're going to stay at my boy's Chuck's house. We've been doing car washes to raise money to get you out here. And I remember thinking, like, what have I got myself into? And I didn't know who...
Car wash.
I don't know who Chuck was, but it was like I knew Chuck had, like, Chuck was no joke. Yeah. Like, Chuck was no joke. And I'm out here with Golden Child. He's freaking 16. Yeah. He's a snot-nosed little 16-year-old kid. And he was being such a pain that day on the video shoot, and I had to threaten him. I was gonna tell his dad. I was gonna tell your dad how you acted, and he shaped up right away.
He was being a little diva.
But I remember we shot hoops in the street, and it was Sonny who lived across the street, right?
Yeah, Sonny Wood. Both of them. The trip, huh? Small world.
It's a very small world, man. I remember that, like. And I remember thinking how crazy it was that you would pay all that money to bring us out and to shoot the video as an act of good faith, and we still never signed the deal. We still never signed the deal.
Because to me, I was like, man, you know, if we show them, like, dude, we want to work, like, we want to do this, like, just on faith, let's do this. And you know, it to me, I think, you know, in knowing who you were, knowing what you're about, I didn't think that you were gonna do us wrong, you know what I'm saying? So to me, I was like, nah, they know what's up. And then after you met Chuck, you definitely knew, like, okay, I'm not gonna mess with these guys.
I don't ever think I thought about that. I mean, to me, integrity was always really important, you know, being a man of your word. But I also was like, just the one thing, I just was like, I can't sign a deal if there's no distribution.
Yeah.
I think we gave you a bunch of CDs.
Yeah, we sent out packages, some dope packages. We're talking to Sony.
Time,
we're talking to a bunch of different distribution companies, but we didn't lock anything down, and I ended up kind of going more into the film side of stuff. Yeah. And was what it was. But how have record deals changed since then?
There is no record deals, like, not the way I got a deal.
Yeah,
I mean. Record labels are really just glorified management companies now in a lot of ways. So the deals now are what they call 360 deals, and they take 360 degrees of your revenue. They never did that with the deals I got. It was just strictly about making music. But I've also realized that you don't need a label anymore. Like, you really don't. Like, unless the label, and there's no artist, that's the other thing, is there's no artist development. It's just, all labels do is they find a pre-existing thing that's doing well and just try to throw some money behind it.
Yeah.
And that's just a sad state. And
back in our time, there was artist development.
Artist development.
They'd polish you up and make you a rock star. Yeah.
Or tell you to shave your head and put tattoos
on.
Yeah, that's very important.
That was Rescue Records.
Artist development. Like, he's like, I'm going to trot you out to some of the cholos. Shave your head and give you tattoos, and they'd be like, "What do you mean I can't pray to Mary Holmes?" Never forget you said that.
You
cracked me up when you said that.
Did we go out to some of the events out there and at the GMA thing?
I think we probably did roll. I mean, we definitely did hang. I'm sure.
Because it was like Grits were performing, and I don't know what else.
Yeah,
there was all kinds of stuff going on out there.
That's a very different time.
But anyway, so now, on the business side of it, you went, you did all these record deals.
Yes.
You got to a point where you were being told you're too old to do this. I don't think
anybody specifically said that. Now, granted, some people said that through someone else, mm-hmm. so I have to filter that. But absolutely. Well, the sentiment is that if they're going to sign anybody, they want to sign a new artist.
Yeah.
And I've been around too long that I'm definitely not signing a 360 deal.
Yeah.
I did have label interest, but it just didn't make sense anymore. You know?
So now you just put out a record.
Yes.
Was it last week?
Last Friday.
Last Friday, you put out a record.
Yes, my first independent record in 17 years.
Crowdfunded. And it's on the top of the Billboard charts.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And tell me about that.
I mean, I did my last Mental album came out through my manager's label. Since then, we have parted ways, unfortunately.
How many albums you got? Like 11 albums?
I don't even know, man.
Yeah, you got a ton of albums.
If you count side projects and like remixes.
You got the band.
I might be around 12 or 13, something like that. But
what was the name of your band?
Let's not talk about it. It's very not important.
It wasn't even a band, man.
It was not a band. You know, Peace of Mind, I did this thing called Peace of Mind. It was a side project. It was literally out of anger. I did that thing out of anger because I got tired of all these rap. I kept getting dissed by the industry, and I'm like, y'all keep running out of these rock bands. I'm like, I can go out and do my own rock band just to say I did it. The whole thing was an experiment. Like, there was no band. It was just Pete Stewart doing all the guitar work. And that was it. And Todd doing the programming. Still sold 20,000 records. It was hilarious. Anyway.
And then you were also part of DC Talk for a little bit, right? I had to throw that in there.
You know, the first time that ever happened, I just stood there dumbfounded. Because they went on for 10 minutes, and I'm like, they're just like, man, I appreciate your music. I appreciate everything you've done. And I'm like, you know, my ego. No, they didn't get to that. That's what I'm saying. They said it at the end of the 10 minutes, so my ego just keeps getting inflated. And then he goes, man, I just, you know, I've been following you since you're in DC Talk all these years. And I'm like, excuse me? They're like,
that's awesome.
Yeah, you know, I just think it's crazy how you're still relevant. And I'm like, who do you think I am, man? Like, I thought, well, that was an isolated incident. And then it happened again. And then it happened again. And I thought, people just don't pay attention.
Toby Mac, right? They think you're Toby Mac.
They would think, you know, I hate the stereotype, but it was always in the Deep South. God bless the Deep South.
Yeah, that happens. So you've been compared to Eminem as well in the industry.
Yes. Yeah, all the way back in 98, you know.
I've heard some tracks, though. There's some similarities. You've done some songs, some Eminem-ish.
Here's the funny thing, right? So the record that you helped fund, mm-hmm. which became 7th Avenue, that record was done independently before I had a deal. So I did most of it before I got signed. I was trying to create a voice that would be unique. I didn't know. That was my problem in Sons of Intellect. I felt like my voice wasn't very unique. So I was trying to create a sound. I never listened to an Eminem record. Didn't even know who he was. I did started doing open mics in South Beach. And they were like, oh, you got to check out this Eminem guy. I still never heard his music. My album was done, finished, gets picked up. He comes out before me by a couple months. And then my album drops. And all of a sudden, everybody's like, yo, this guy sounds like Slim Shady. I'm like, how would I have this convoluted plan to sound like Eminem if I never even heard his music? But it didn't matter. So by default, I became associated with him. And it's probably just because of the fact our registers of our tones sat in a higher register, nasally, you know. So it is what it is. I don't fight that. But it was never an intentional thing. If anything, I started dumbing down my rhyme schemes to not be like, hi, Renee, toss a live grenade in your driveway, and I drived away. Like, I'm purposely not trying to rhyme in that structure. Never listened to his records. But it was a thing that dogged me for years and years and years.
You're like the Christian Eminem.
Well, I realized then is that the same reason why I like Christian rap, because it was an alternative to me, that I began to fulfill that same thing in people's lives. And so I was like, it's kind of wrong for me to shoot that down if someone goes, you got me off Eminem. To be like, no, I didn't, because I don't even sound like him. I'll just be like, all right, cool.
Yeah.
You know, And then, of course, it didn't help that I wrote a song to him, and that went through the roof.
Yeah. Yeah, that was kind of like took you to a whole another level.
I never thought that would go anywhere. I mean, like, it's a 24-bar verse song, you know?
And did he listen to it?
Well, that's the thing is, because of POD, a lot of people don't know this, but Dave Sosby was POD's road pastor at the time. He was with Sonny when he saw Slim and went to Sonny and said, "Do you think I should give it to him?" And Sonny said, "Yeah, man, go for it."
Nice.
And it was because of POD, he was able to give Eminem my song.
Nice. Did you ever hear anything back from...
I mean, he put out a song a couple years ago called Be Careful What You Wish For, and it talks about a fan who had been praying for him and how it had been weighing on his mind and how, you know, he didn't read every letter he gets. So it sounds like it's a response. I don't know if it is. You know, I can't guarantee it, but it sounds like it. I did talk to his ex-wife when she was in jail a lot. Mm-hmm. I was able to talk to her through a prison guard. I've met people that know him. I met the guy whose aunt married them. He got married in the Assemblies of God Church in Kansas City.
On a trip.
So there's always been weird things like that, but no, I've never talked to him directly or had any type of correspondence.
Wow.
If I never did, it wouldn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, it was still monumental. But you had a couple songs, Fan Mail.
Yeah.
Where there's, you know, there's people talking about how your words and your music affected their life. Tell me a little bit about that.
I mean, basically, you know, just started getting letters. I mean, kids like, "I was suicidal, I put your music on, it stopped me," or "I'm still suicidal," or "I'm self-injury, I like to cut myself." I just realized there was just a litany of things that kids were going through that I was a blind eye in the church to, you know. So, I mean, I just write songs that are based on where people are going at or where they're at. And that was really all it was.
Yeah.
That's what Fan Mail came from. You know, it was literally based on real letters. I used actual fans on the chorus parts.
That's dope.
If there's any reason why I'm still able to be around is that the two things I've always tried to do is listen to God and listen to the people.
Yeah.
And that's, it keeps you a long career, you know.
And I think in listening to the people, there was a lot of demand for you to do a song with Lecrae.
Yeah.
And tell me about that and how that came.
Well, 10 years ago, I met Lecrae before he even really came out. I met him at a youth pastor event, and it's funny. He pulled me aside and he started grilling me, and nicely and respectfully, but he was definitely like checking me, and it was almost like, you know, why are you in it? What are you doing? And it kind of had a bit of like tone like, You're this funny, goofy white boy. Like, are you really about ministry? And similar to the way I kind of like checked you, I respected.
Smoking cigars, Holmes.
I said, "You want to go smoke a cigar, Lecrae?" No, I respected the fact that he wasn't like trying to get something out of me or kiss my butt or anything. He was just literally like respectfully checking me.
Yeah.
And I passed his music along to my DJ, who passed it along to a label, and nothing really came out. I ran into him again like a couple months later at another event. And in my head, I thought, this guy has talent. I wonder if the Christian music industry will ever embrace a Southern rapper. That was my concern, because I was so used to this suburban white world that I lived in. I thought, it's going to be really hard for a legitimate black rapper to be embraced from the South.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, like, the industry changed, you know, or they carved out their own niche. So the funny thing was, I reached out to him almost right away to do a song, and he turned me down.
Wow.
He's like, I don't want to... He turned me down because he felt like if he did it, he was going to do it from the wrong motives. He felt like he was going to do it because it would help his career, and he felt like that was wrong, which I thought was really impressive.
Yeah, it's pretty bold.
So I circled around like another album later, tried again. This time, he wrote a chorus for me. He wrote he did that chorus.
The one that you guys did, the Lightning?
No, this was before that record. He wrote a chorus for me because I was struggling with the song and then did not want to be compensated. He didn't want to be credited. He completely gave me the chorus, which became a semi-popular song.
What song was it?
It's called He Did That. It was based on, you know, this kind of drumline beat and stuff like that. And I thought that was really, you know, unique that he would do that. So here we are like three records later. I'll share a story with you I've never shared before. I won the Dove Award that year
for like...
You won six, right?
I won six. So one of those is for like... I won a remix. I had a remix album, okay? And it won the Dove that year. And I really kind of felt like that was like not cool. You know what I mean? And he had a... I felt like he deserved to win it that year. Like for me to win for remix album and he had like a very successful first and second album, I was like, this is not right. The irony was when I went to get my Dove, they gave me a blank one. And they never sent, gave me my real one. And then they never took away the blank one. Then a couple months later, they sent me another blank one. So I ended up winning two Doves and then having two blank Doves.
Wow.
So what I did was I went to a trophy shop and I took my two Doves and I put his name on it.
On both of them?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
For the two categories I thought he should have won. So
that's awesome.
I took them and I put his record and his single and I put it on. Maybe it was just one. I don't remember if it was one or two. Anyway, the point was I made it essentially look like how my Dove looked. And I sent it to him and I said, you should have won this. I can't give you mine, but I think it's not an accident that I got this blank one. And I didn't tell him I was doing it. I just got his address. I sent it to his house and he called me and he was like, just like, can't believe you did that. You know, like, that's not something we do as rappers. We don't like give away our trophies. But I felt like, you know what, man, one thing we don't do well in our industry is uplift each other. We're good at being competitive with each other, but we don't uplift each other. And I said, you deserved it more than I did. And whether you ever get one or not, I want you to know that I believe in you and I believe in what you do and you should have this. And we prayed together and I think that was probably a turning point. I think that's when he kind of realized like I wasn't in it. You know, I said, and I told him too, I said, you made me check my motives years ago of why I'm trying to collaborate. So I want to in turn just tell you that I appreciate that because that helped me. So that's where They Like Me came out of. You know, that was essentially then when he was like, okay, let's do a song together. And I said, well, if we're going to do something, let's not do the typical Jesus rah-rah song. I said, let's talk about things that nobody wants to talk about. Let's talk about racial issues. And that's where They Like Me came from.
You know? Yeah, I was digging the video too.
Yeah, so that was it was a watershed moment for my career. Because in a lot of ways, you know, not that things started fading for me, because they never faded, but I did notice my sales dipped and, you know, his sales were going through the roof. And, you know, there was a point in me where I had to kind of go, okay, you know, I'm moving into the next phase of my career, which is becoming a longevity artist, where it's not about sales, it's just more about legacy and things like that, and maintaining and, you know, stuff like that. And so that video to this day has the most views of any video I've ever done. Still do it live.
That was dope.
You know, and the funny thing was it kind of preceded any talk about racial issues in the church. I mean, now you hear it all the time. Christian rappers talk about social issues all the time now. Nobody was talking about it back then. Back then, like it was so long ago.
Do you think at that point in your career, like, you both needed each other, like he needed you and you needed him?
I don't think he needed me as much as... A white voice needed to say what was being said, and a black voice needed to be said, and it needed to be said together. You know what I mean? And I don't even know if I necessarily needed him, but I needed his voice. I think that's really what it was. It was a cultural exchange. That's the best way I can explain it. He had to talk about what it was like to be a black male embraced by the white church. I had to talk about what it was like to be a white male living in a black world of either hip-hop or my upbringing and the struggles that you deal with that. So that's where we met. And then literally going, we're from two different worlds, but we have more in common than we don't. You know?
That's dope, man.
And the funny thing is, I don't even know if I would write that type of song anymore. I don't think he would write that song anymore. But it was a moment in time, you know?
Is there any other... within the industry, is there anyone else that you would want to collaborate with that you haven't?
Honestly, at this point, probably not. I mean, maybe Toby. We've never really done a song together. I don't know if that'll ever happen, but I mean...
Weren't you just brought up on stage to do like something?
A couple years ago.
Jesus Freak or
something.
Yeah, right?
Well, I've done Jesus Freak now with everybody except for Kevin. Toby, ironic. I do Toby's music camp like every year for like 7 years now. So he brought me up in the middle of his performance and he goes, he was like, he goes, I thought he wanted me to hype man for him. He just like steps aside and goes, go ahead, do my rap.
He's like, I already heard you do it a million times. Yeah, I see videos all the time popping up everywhere.
Well,
of you doing that.
Right. But you know what? I'll be honest with you. I think there always was a bit of, between me and Toby, just a, not a weirdness, because there's always a great mutual respect. But I kind of, I didn't understand his place in the industry until I became similar to his place in the industry. So I had said something one time in an interview like, oh, I hope to have a career as long as Toby's, you know, he's in his mid-40s. Well, he wasn't in his mid-40s when I said that. He was still in his early 40s. But in my head, I'm like, oh, I'm complimenting you. But it's really kind of an insult. You know what I'm saying? But I didn't understand it as a man in his 30s. So now that I'm older, I'm going, oh, dang, if some, like, kid, like, gave me an extra 5 years right now, I'd be a little irritated with that. Something about that night, I went to him and I apologized. And I said, I totally understand what I did now, how that was kind of wrong. And me being thrown in the mix with Jesus Freak and the legacy that doing, you know, the version on Newsboys. And I was like, I hope you understand that I have nothing but great admiration and respect for you. And we've always had great conversations. And I just hope you understand that. And he goes, oh, man, of course, you know. And I don't know. I think now I understand what it's like, not nowhere on the level that he's been through, but I do understand what it's like to be in an industry where they don't understand hip hop and you have to do so much dumbing down, you know, just to survive. Yeah. The best thing he ever told me is when I just met him, he goes, I've always tried to play to the entire room. And I thought, huh.
That's a good piece of advice.
And that changed my perspective because I didn't play to the whole room when I was coming up. My goal was like to hit the one hip-hop head with these bars.
And speaking of like the industry as a whole, did you ever not want to be labeled as a Christian rapper?
I think maybe in the Sons of Intellect days, I don't know if I necessarily ever said don't call me a Christian rapper, but we definitely were on some like covert, we had some like weird thing about like, we're going to infiltrate the behind the enemy lines, and like I was all this military stuff. I don't think I ever took it as an insult, but yeah, there was times where I was like maybe a little bit deflective of the label, but
well, you know, like when we're doing the POD thing, it was like, well, you know, the Beastie Boys aren't Buddhist rap, or you know, Buddhist rock, Buddhist rap, why are you labeling us, you know, a Christian band? Like, we're not, you know what I'm saying? Like, it was always that, like, wait a minute, we're doing something for everyone.
But I would counter that statement by saying it's not like the Beastie Boys ever rapped about Buddha.
It's true.
Whereas the content, if the content of your music, maybe not all of it is about Christ, but if it is talking about Christ, then that's why people want to label you a Christian rapper. Yeah. You know what I mean?
And were you anti that though? Like,
no, I was just, I don't know, man, I was just trying to figure it out back then. I think We were doing all kinds of shows. We were doing straight up church shows. We were doing on the street ministry, and we were opening up for Outkast, and we were opening up for Tribe Called Quest, and we were opening up for Mobb Deep and the biggest of the biggest names back then. So I think I came to a point where I realized like people are just gonna label you whatever they want to label you. Like when we would be in these like weeded out secular environments, it would just be like, yo, y'all down for that Jesus ish? Yeah, I respect that. Yeah, you want to hit this real quick? I'm like, they don't get it. You know what I mean? And then now now if somebody goes, hey, what do you do? What's your job? I tell them Christian rapper. I don't even think twice about it because now I realize it opens up so many opportunities. The car rental I had yesterday. It's like, oh, why are you in town? Oh, I'm here to do this. Oh, okay, what do you do? I'm a Christian rapper. Really? They go, that's cool. They have some nice beats.
That's awesome. And now you're doing...
she said nice beats.
Now you're doing corporate stuff. You're doing... What else did you say you were doing up there? You're doing camp stuff?
You know what? I've been doing corporate events for almost 12 years. Like,
that's awesome.
There used to be this weird, like, forgive the term, pissing contest about, like, how much secular raps, you know, environments you could rap in. And I was like, man, I've been in, like, mainstream environments for my whole career.
Yeah.
It's just... I don't open up for Kendrick Lamar. I open up for George Bush.
Yeah, that's dope.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, I realize, like,
it's just platforms. That's all it is.
What's the best piece of advice that you've gotten?
Best piece of advice I've gotten.
Because you've been in the industry for a minute.
Best piece of advice I've gotten. I don't know if there's one particular piece. I can tell you things that I've gleaned.
Yeah, so
you know, which is just like things like, I mean, just little personal philosophies is like, always take care of the people that take care of you. Be the first one there and the last one to leave. Listen to the God and listen to the people. You know, play to the whole room. Always perform to the whole room. Don't perform to a specific group. And stay on your face before God. I think that's just the things I've come away with.
What's the best piece of advice you would give somebody trying to get into the industry?
Oh, man. It would be the same thing I was given to me, which is essentially approach it like a missionary going off to a foreign country. So a missionary would want to be fluent in the language. A missionary would want to know the culture and the customs and the history. A missionary would want to be excellent in the way they disperse their music, you know, what they're trying to say. And a missionary would realize that you have to like spend years getting ready before you go. Dax from LPG back in the day gave me this analogy, and it just always stuck with me. He talked about, you know, when David went to slay Goliath, he took 5 smooth stones, and we failed to remember that those stones had sat there in the water having all the impurities washed away so they could be used. You know, they were the perfect size and the perfect weight, and all their roughness, smooth roughness, had been taken away. And he was basically saying, like, sometimes you got to sit in the stream for a while. That always stuck with me.
I like that. Yeah, I like that.
And
so, would you also recommend, hey, you don't need a label?
I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all. I think some people do need a label. You got to be very much a self-starter and very self-motivated. If you're not, then she should not, you know. I think it's the difference he's saying, do you need a label? We're all going to the same internet. Mm. We're all not making any money off the music because it's all streaming. But we all have the opportunity to step up to the plate and hit a home run. That's the big difference now.
So what are the ways for income now in this day and age with, you know, being a musician, being a rapper, being an artist? What are the streams of income?
It's the same it's always been. I mean, when I came in, I didn't expect to make any money off my records. I expected it's going to be touring. It's going to be merchandise. It's going to be label. You know, it's going to be partnerships with people. It's the same thing.
Are you doing? You're doing motivational speaking as well, right?
I mean, I always kind of have. I don't do like. I'm not like Tony Robbins or anything, but I do. I do multiple motivational events, but I do music at it. I don't speak at it, but yeah, I've been speaking for years and years and years.
Are you still a youth pastor?
No, I haven't done that since I put the mic. I turned the mic on. But I do operate in a similar pastor role at my church. I'm launching a once-a-month young adults event, but I'm not a pastor there. Yeah. So.
But you still hold the title, pastor.
No, I don't. I don't hold the title. Thank God, no.
That's a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, but I mean, I've done it before. It's not that. It's just going, a pastor is a shepherd, and if I can't be there because I'm traveling, I can't shepherd. So I don't think I should wear that term.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't take it lightly. I've always, you know... I've always tried to be, titles and labels have never been my thing.
Well, you know, we've kind of been full circle on the business side of it. Because when you do a record deal, you're putting out an album, usually you're trying to do put a single out, do a video. Who's are you doing any videos now that you're not on a label? Are you pushing stuff on the radio?
Well, two things I noticed was one, nobody listens to the radio anymore. We are our own radio programmers because we have our own playlists and we don't want to be told what to listen to. So, not that I've neglected radio, but I've also just been like, I'm putting money into things that I know is going to hopefully return. So, I did a single, and I've sent stuff off to the DJs, and you know, I still service those areas, but Christian radio is so weird. Like, they're going to play whatever they feel like. You can say, oh, this is a single. They're like, nah, we're going to play this song. It's just a convoluted formats. But and also I noticed is that you can shoot a music video and people can love it, and they only watch the first minute of it. Yeah. Like, our attention spans are so little. Yeah. So I'm like, why am I spending all this money shooting music videos when you don't make any money back on the video? Nobody buys the song. Yeah. Nobody buys the album. I just dropped a couple thousand. I was like, forget it. I'm going to shoot one-minute videos. Yeah. I'm going to shoot a verse and a chorus for 1 minute. I can throw that out through all my social media. Yeah. It makes you now have to go listen to the song. Yeah. It makes you either have to go buy the song, and you ain't got the attention span? Cool. Doesn't matter. Yeah. I can shoot 8 1-minute music videos for the price of one full-length video.
On your iPhone.
On my iPhone.
Just, boom. Done deal. Done deal. Yeah, times have changed, dude.
Times have changed.
Dude, we, you know, we're shooting, you know, big old cameras on film. We had to go develop it and go do colorize it, go do all that stuff. And now it's like, oh, let me pull up my my iPhone and drop it on Facebook Live.
People took photography cameras and turned them into video cameras.
It's nuts, man. It's nuts. Times done changed. But no, man, I know we're creeping up on an hour here, and it's getting late. But, man, I want to thank you for your time, man, and sharing your wealth of knowledge that you got in the music industry. Hopefully we can touch base soon and you can share some more stuff. But
absolutely.
You know, you've been traveling, you're yawning, and we're out here in the middle of
2:15 in the morning.
We're
back home.
It's like a lounge, food and drinks and all kinds of stuff going on over here. But all kinds of madness. No cigar smoking, but you know, it's close. But no, thank you for your time, man. Appreciate
you, man.
Thank you for 20 years
of Ruben in my life. El Ruben. I used to look at the back of those magazines and it said, send demos to El Ruben.
El Ruben. Yeah.
El Ruben.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And I was like, oh, you're El Ruben.
Yeah, it's funny. I still kind of pick up some of that stuff and like just laugh and reminisce. But
well, when I was making this album, I went back and found, going through and finding old stuff, I found all those old magazines.
That's funny.
And here's the funny thing I thought was, back then, if you wanted Christian rap, I mean, you go to your bookstore and get like the 10 titles that were out, if there was. But you had to scour these magazines, see these new artists, and send off a check and hope to God the tape would show up. And if it did show up, you'd be like, it may suck too. You really had no idea.
Yeah.
And it was very much like a mail order kind of thing. And I thought, as I brought 150 CDs to the post office to mail them, I'm like, I can't believe I'm back mailing out music. I'm back mailing
now
out
it's just download,
CDs.
Download.
But I'm just saying, like, I'm literally back to where I was 20 years prior.
Yeah, that's how it was, man. We used to have to send out cassette tapes and T-shirts in the mail and all that craziness and records, CDs.
The irony is, here I am 20 years later, the first album that's paid for before I even put it out.
Man.
That didn't happen before.
Well, congrats on your success.
Yes, sir. Thank you, man.
And keep doing it, man. You know, hopefully you're still rocking out when you're 60, 70.
I hope not. If we're here 20 years later doing a podcast, I'm not going to do it with you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to have to find Chuck. I'm going to come hold you down. We'll do it. No, man, but appreciate you, man. Appreciate your time. And,
You know what? On a side note, I got $20 for freestyle today.
Wow, you got a $20 tip for free? See? Tax free? There you go, dude.
Freestyle. Rhyme pays. Word to Ice-T.
I'm telling you. Rapping on the streets SD.
Yeah, man.
Well, cool, man. Appreciate your time.
Appreciate you guys.
How can we find you on social media?
Well, KJFatu.com has a lot of you can buy my album there. You can buy the download. I make 100% of the profits on that. But obviously, you can go to iTunes, Spotify, all the new record Jonah is there. You can follow me at KJ Fatu Instagram. You can follow me at KJ Fatu is my Facebook page. You can holler at me at KJ Fatu is on Twitter. But KJFatu.com, actually the best place to start because it's like the one-stop shop for everything.
KJ52? You hate that, huh? The 52.
No, man. Like, what the heck was I thinking at 20 years old to not spell it out phonetically?
It just worked out. 5-2. What do you use the most, though? What social media?
It's probably split between Instagram and Facebook.
All right. We'll find you there. Well, I'll let you know when this comes out, and we'll touch base, man. Good looking out. Appreciate you. KJ5 Tweezy, we out of here. SD, 20 years later. Doing it big. Thanks, brother.